Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Coming up, Uber gets into the autonomous vehicle race. But what does this mean for its relationship with Google? And more importantly, what will it do for your independence? Will you be my eyes? There are thousands of volunteers around the world who would be. We'll analyze the pros and cons of this app that has taken the community by storm. And this new study claims the way we think of seeing may be outdated. Batman is back in the media. We'll discuss, you decide, on episode 223 of the Serotalk Podcast.
Bringing you the best in mainstream and assistive technology developments, news, and analysis. This is the Serotalk Podcast, a service of Serotech Corporation, makers of accessibility anywhere, iBlink Radio, and Remote Incident Manager. Visit us online at www.serotech.com. And now, here's your host, Joe Orozco.
Welcome to Serotalk 223, generously brought to you by Audible. For your choice of free audiobook, go to audiblepodcast.com/serotalk. And welcome to a new cast of voices. I'm Joe Orozco.
I'm Katie Frederick.
I'm Lane Amaro.
And I'm Steve Sawson.
I also want to send a shout out to the new team over on our sister podcast, Triple Click Home. If you haven't checked out their Midlife Crisis episode, it's definitely one worth checking out. As well as a newcomer to the network, Bill Kosiaba brings us the Kosiaba Fitness Show, which promises to bring us health and wellness from some of the biggest names in the industry. And a final announcement of note, on Thursday, February 19th at 7 p.m. Eastern, there will be a SAMNet meet and greet by your content directors, Hope and Derek. This will be in the welcome lobby. If you are not a current SAMNet subscriber, you can change that by clicking over to serotech.com/SAMNet. Download your copy of the trial software. Lots of exciting changes going on at Serotech and SPN. It's enough to make you feel a little goo-goo for Google. Lane, this first piece comes from you, and in it you point out that 7 out of the 8 Ivy Leagues and 72 out of the top 100 universities in the country have switched to Google Web Apps, which would be fine, except that the blindness community has the perception that Google Apps just aren't accessible. You beg to differ.
Yeah, it definitely is a misconception. Yeah, the Google Web Apps may not be totally ideal for some situations, but it's not necessarily because of a lack of accessibility. I tend to actually recommend that people who are struggling with new websites that are taking advantage of HTML5 get started using the Google Web App environment. It's relatively stable, and the accessibility, at least for Windows users using Firefox and NVDA, have a major advantage.
So let me ask you something. You point out that sometimes people blame the way that the web page is constructed, and sometimes it's the AT companies that are two steps behind. How do you reconcile that?
Just kind of have to wait. Unfortunately, none of us are perfect. And so web developers make mistakes. Our AT manufacturers make mistakes. Your AT instructors and tech support make mistakes. So as things are, especially in such a changing environment like the web, a little bit of patience goes a long way, really. There's so much tolerance, though, too. Like, I understand that people get impatient or don't want to tolerate waiting too long. It's definitely not just the manufacturers of assistive tech or the web designers.
So you make a pretty bold claim on here, which I thought was interesting. You point out that sometimes it's the fault of the AT trainers because sometimes it's too inconvenient. You stand by that claim?
Oh, yeah. As an assistive technology instructor for a state voc rehab agency, I know exactly how overwhelmed AT instructors in training environments are. And they have 40 hours a week that they can give. Some of us at state agencies get punished for going over that 40-hour mark. You know, I don't know necessarily about some of the private training agencies, but those AT trainers have a set number of people that they work with. They have a set, in some cases, a set curriculum. And so for them to step outside of what they're doing to just prepare for their students every day, that takes a lot of effort on their part, a lot of time on their part. And as AAT instructors, sometimes we overlook something because it took more than 5 minutes to go in and figure out how to use it for a client. And we'll direct clients elsewhere. And it's just, well, there's just not enough time in the day.
Right. Steve, you're also an AAT trainer. Have you had much experience with Google Apps with your clients?
I have. Not so much for clients, but now that I've worked with other organizations that use Google Apps as their internal infrastructure. And so I sort of find myself in the place of needing to be able to use these things and be able to perform work efficiently through using them. And it's a definite challenge. I think, frankly, I'm happy that I don't need to train them because I think there's quite a bit to learn and it would take a lot of time to learn all that. I think I could do it, but I think it requires a lot of time that a lot of AT instructors simply just don't have. As was just mentioned, we only have X number of hours per week, and devoting the time necessary to really absorb all of the accessibility improvements in Google Apps and also the various AT technologies and how that all interfaces together is a huge challenge. The other piece, which I found sort of puzzling, and maybe I'm just not looking in the right places, but Google has certainly put a lot of effort into creating a great deal of documentation describing how to use many of the accessibility features, including many keyboard shortcuts for many of the apps. I was amazed how many keyboard shortcuts exist, for example, for Google Hangouts and, of course, for Google Docs. But I had a lot of difficulty finding these right off the bat. And I think a lot of people just may assume they don't exist or just are simply unaware of the accessibility enhancements that are present. And Google doesn't really put that out there. I mean, there's blog posts and such, but unless you really search for it, sometimes I found it hard to find that documentation.
And in addition to having trouble finding it too, Steve, I'm also finding that people look, when they do find them, they look at those keystrokes and try them and they don't work as expected. And it's just, you know, it's kind of that learning curve of interacting with that HTML5 environment and disabling the, well, if you're using JAWS, the forms mode, if you're using Window Eyes, the browse mode, and if you're using NVDA, the focus mode, and then implementing the keystrokes. And when you read through their documentation, it's hard to tell the difference between their Google keystrokes and keystrokes that you're accustomed to using in that Windows environment. So definitely getting access to those training materials, even just the list of keystrokes, can be tricky.
Yeah, I'm one of those people that I use when I have to use the web interface or Gmail, for example. I'm still using plain HTML because when I try the standard version, I get frustrated. Like I know that, for example, if you want to get rid of a whole mess of messages, you can do that in the standard version, not in the plain HTML. So, you know, doing something like that is fine, but then you can go and try to adjust settings, like, crap, you know, where is this thing? And you know, it seems like more trouble than it's worth. So I'm definitely one of those consumers that would do well to read some of this documentation and maximize it.
I use Gmail on the web sometimes too, and I like it, but I also get frustrated because I look at the help and it says, oh, well, click on this icon. Or, you know, I think Google could do better at promoting the fact that it is making this progress with accessibility in terms of keyboard shortcuts and things. I think it could do a little bit better job at making that known.
And I think that's where some AT instructors can come into to play as well. For the culminating project in my graduate program, which I finished in December, the master's is official. It's a part of that culminating project. Yeah, it was a part of that culminating project. One of my classmates and I created a web set of tutorials for using Gmail and using Hangouts because that piece there is missing. It's not perfect, that's for sure. We didn't do as much as we wanted to, but it's a great start. So if anybody who's interested, it's www.googleax.com. And you got to sign up for it just because as part of our project, we kind of had to keep track of people coming and going, but totally secure. But it was definitely like, I see that piece missing as well. So the AT instructors out there who can fill that gap and make those connections for the users definitely would make a huge impact in the number of people using or accessing the Google Web Apps.
So the big takeaway that I'm hearing then is to use Firefox with NVDA. That's going to probably put you in the most ideal environment.
NVDA, and you know, I've done a little bit of testing with WindowEyes 9, and it's been very little. I actually need to call tech support because for some reason my files are missing. WindowEyes files suddenly disappeared. So I should probably straighten that out. But it's, the little bit I did do with it, it was working pretty well, and it was much more intuitive. I've been doing some testing with JAWS for Windows in the Google Web App environment, and I get a lot of repetition. It gets really annoying to hear the same thing three or four times before you can move on. So
it's frustrating in Gmail.
I've had the best luck.
How about Google Chrome?
Yeah, best luck with NVDA.
I feel bad for Google Chrome because I know they've spent a lot of time on it, and they think it's fantastic. I've seen many, many demonstrations where they whip out their Chromebook or a laptop with Google Chrome, and they show off how awesome Google Docs is. And I spoke with a gentleman who's leading up some initiatives with Google Docs, and he was totally miffed that I was not using Google Chrome as my primary screen reader. And I had a lot of responses to that, but then I thought, no, I better not say any of these. But did you use Google Chrome at all? Because they swear it's fantastic. Of course they would, since they make it, but I don't know of anyone who is sort of screaming its praises from the rooftops because of how well it works with Google Apps, and that's what they claim its forte is.
Yeah, I tend not to use the Chrome browser. I cannot explain it, but every time I have installed the Chrome browser on my Windows machine, I get a virus. It's probably just my own experience, but I have tried to install Chrome and use Chrome Vox on my Windows machine. I did have really good luck, though, with a Chromebook with the Chrome Vox extension enabled. The response is tremendous. So much faster, so much more accurate. I can't stand the synthesizer.
But it was responsive, because that's been my complaint with Windows. It's just laggy. It's hard to get anything done, especially if you're trying to edit a document.
Yes. On Windows, it is very unresponsive. In the Chrome OS, though, it's incredibly responsive. If you can tolerate the synthesizer, it's worse than eSpeak Max.
So I have a Toshiba 2 Chromebook, and I'm not ready really to talk about my experience because it's been kind of a mood swing thing, kind of like it was when I first got my iPod, you know, like many years ago.
Yeah.
It's good. I think the performance is a good point to bring up, though, because that so much of that also can depend on the hardware. The Chromebook, for example, works well, but it's more of a display machine. It looks pretty, right? And so I think if I had to do it over again, I'd probably go for a Dell. You know, it's, you know, smaller product, but the performance is so much better. The display is not as great, but if you can't see the display, it doesn't matter. I agree the synthesizer is a little bit to get used to, but I'm actually a little surprised. I'm pleasantly surprised at what you can do.
Has anyone tried any of these Google applications from a Mac voiceover point of view?
Not yet.
Not recently.
It's on my to-do list.
Ironically, Chrome worked pretty good on the Mac. I mean, there were some things that didn't work well, but Chrome does work pretty well. Yeah, and I think Google Docs works fairly well. I haven't played around much with a lot of so Google Docs and Google Hangouts are the two apps that I struggle with most often, although apparently Google Sites is something I need to figure out pretty quickly. So, but the Mac does work pretty well with both of those. And if you do want to go the Chrome Vox route, since Google swears by it, if you can stand the speech and deal with, you know, some sluggishness, just like on Windows, you can install Chrome and the Google Vox extension, which will also work on Mac.
There was a post, I actually wrote a post on the Serotalk blog, and in one of the comments, what I'm going to do, I'm going to take those links out and put them in the show notes, but one of the commenters gave a host of resources for Chrome. So we'll share those with you in the show notes. Check those out. Speaking of Google, though, in the context of Uber, because Uber is opening a research center for self-driving cars. Uber, of course, is a private car service. It prides itself on having created tens of thousands of jobs around the world. But in the future, it's claiming that the human element, at least the driver portion of it, will not be as important. Now, Katie, Uber has, this isn't the first time that they kind of go out beyond their rideshare service. They've done food delivery, cargo transportation, and courier service. So self-driving car, is that far left field for you?
You know, when I first heard about a self-driving car, I was very skeptical, and I still am, because while I love technology a lot and it's really changed my life, I just am a little leery of trusting it to drive me around. So I think that this certainly has an interesting development future, but especially as Google is becoming involved, not only because Google and Uber have some connections in terms of, apparently one of Google's board members is connected to Uber in some way, so there's that connection, which is interesting in itself, but...
Well, they're a major investor for Uber.
Yes,
so it's kind of interesting, right, that Uber's kind of breaking out on its own.
Right. So I think it will be interesting to watch as this concept of the self-driving car manifests and to see where it goes in the future. I think that, yes, it will be a possibility, but in terms of accessibility and actual usability and the social context, I think that's a ways off, but certainly something to continue to watch as stories are published about it, for sure.
Well, they themselves say, you know, this is in the future. I know that Ford and a couple of other major brands are also talking about autonomous vehicles. And this research center that Uber is opening in Pennsylvania is being launched in conjunction with Carnegie Mellon University, which is a leader in robotics and autonomous vehicles. So this isn't like a toss it in the wind and see what happens. I mean, they're aligning themselves with some great partners. And among, you know, some of the things that they plan to do is mapping and vehicle safety research. So we really might have a world where driverless cars are a reality. Now, here's my question, though. Right now, you can call up a taxi or, you know, page a Uber or whatever, and you can tell them, hey, you know, I'm blind. And if you're especially in a public crowded place, you know, say, look for me, I'm wearing blah, blah, blah. How does this work with a driverless car?
I think there are a lot of questions that we obviously don't know. I mean, maybe it will have some kind of a chip in it, like a phone
facial
that, you know,
you would send
a selfie, right? Or something. I don't know. True, blind people trying to take selfies, blind selfie. I don't know. But I think that, yeah, I mean, again, there are a lot of questions. And then, you know, what about people who are not just blind, but maybe deafblind, or, you know, will it be accessible for all in whatever way the cars are hailed?
I can think of all kinds of questions. I don't want to be in that car right after the drunk guy who just vomited all over the back seat. Uh-huh. You know, and it, having a service dog, I mean, mm-hmm. that can make it an impact. You know, if you're allergic to dogs, you don't want to be the one getting in the car right after a service dog has been in the car. And I won't go too far afield on service dogs. I really could, but I won't. For how does the driverless car know that it's a service dog and not somebody's filthy pet?
Yeah, or, you know, just the whole communication aspect in terms of, I think it's sad to see that we're losing again another face to face communication. I mean, now it is kind of nice to get in the car and, you know, have a chat. I take Uber from time to time, and I've had interesting conversations with the drivers. You know, I actually do use a guide dog, and they've asked some questions, and I think I've educated them well about guide dogs. And I think that's a good thing to help increase some public awareness in a, you know, subtle way, where you're just kind of sitting and relaxing and enjoying a ride and both benefiting from sharing information. So
I would be so mad if I was an Uber driver reading this article. The one line that really stuck out to me, whatever this guy's name is, Caligo has long said that the fact that Uber needs drivers is a temporary annoyance.
Yeah, and
if I read that, I would be like, you know, that's all I am to this company? Like,
yeah.
I'm trying to give great service, like you said, you know, I'm engaging with customers. I provide good service. I am looking for blind people that can't see me. Like, you know, I'm, you know, maybe I am a significant part of their revenue, but I'm providing something to the company, and now I'm just a temporary annoyance. Like, I was just totally taken away by that.
That was a pretty harsh statement.
And you get customers in a lot of times you get customers based on the customer service you give.
Yeah.
Or receive, you know, like that feedback, that communication between the service provider and the recipient of the service. I would think it would be a bad business move in that regard because your customers aren't getting customer service anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Although they do say that 80% of the cost goes to the driver. So, I mean, I'm not going to lie, the idea of cheap, really cheap transportation would be, I mean, well, I don't trust it either. But from a cost perspective, that would be kind of neat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's technology worth following for sure. I'm cautiously optimistic. When the NFB started tackling the blind driver challenge, my beef with it was, you know, we're solving for transportation to get to a job, but we can't guarantee that the job is accessible. But since they started that initiative, I mean, so many companies have dedicated resources to this. So I think it's definitely part of our future.
It's interesting that we haven't seen anything. I was looking at the Blind Driver Challenge website. There has not been any new news from them since 2011.
Wow.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and in a way, I mean, they kind of, I know they were partnering with a university in Virginia, but with this kind of proliferating to other more well-founded, more established companies, you know, they can throw more money at it. Maybe it doesn't make sense to continue with that campaign.
Or maybe they'll find some way to brand and work together. I mean, this could be huge for people in the blindness field. I mean, maybe these robots will, you know, maybe there will still be people who will help deploy the robots. I don't know. I mean,
right. Yeah.
Get them where they need to go.
The whole autonomous car, driverless car thing also depends on the communication of the technologies. So you're going to be relying on the cars to talk to one another. You're going to be relying on power supplied to light signals and that sort of thing. And so, you know, when the power goes out in a city, which tends to happen around Idaho quite a bit, and so you're really relying on that technology and those cars and all their signals to communicate for traffic patterns. And there's a lot of discussion about that transition from drivers having control over their vehicles and making decisions for themselves as just sighted drivers and trying to give over that control to the vehicle. You know, there's a lot of psychology behind that for the existing driving community. And I don't know, living out in rural country, you know, I have to fly regularly for my job. Otherwise, it's an eight-hour drive across the mountains and across the state. And there's no regional ground transportation. And I'm thinking, you know, if some sort of signal went out up on one of those mountain roads, if it was too cloudy to get a signal, I could be right off that cliff and no one would know, be the wiser. But if I had put the potential to make my own decisions, if I had that feedback in the car, that tactile or audio feedback in the car to take control if necessary. There's more psychology to that as well. I'm a little bit of a control freak too, so maybe we can blame it on that. But
I think this will be definitely interesting. I did just briefly see an article yesterday about in Germany, there's a committee forming now to discuss how they might or might not implement driverless or self-driving, whatever you want to call them, cars on the Autobahn. Right now, they're not allowed at all whatsoever. And so I think this is coming more and more into the social conversation and becoming more of a widely discussed issue. So it'll just be,
well, if you look at some of the technology that's coming out, like lane assist, rear view cameras, these are things that are becoming standard. And in the case of the rear camera, it's actually going to be a legal mandate, I think, by like 2017 or 18, when all new cars have to be, you know, have to ship with these things built in. And so, and, you know, you have the cars that can park themselves, you know, parallel parking. And so I think society is slowly starting to embrace the idea. I think it's just an idea of losing control that, you know, makes us a little bit skittish. Because I think you're right, Lane, you know, like things that are beyond the power of the car, a smart car or otherwise, I mean, if it's relying on signals and whatnot, and if they are turned off, you know, what happens? So definitely a lot of infrastructure to take into account. And speaking of proliferation of signals, Cisco has made its prediction on the proliferation of data traffic. It's predicted that by 2019, 5.2 billion people are expected to be mobile users. That would mean 69% of the world. Steve, not altogether surprising. Everywhere you look, someone has a smartphone, tablet. When you start taking into account the wearable technology that's starting to come out, is this altogether surprising for you?
Not to me. I was a little surprised that they suggested that people will likely have more than one smartphone, because there are, as much as smartphones are all around us and we see them everywhere, they aren't everywhere. I mean, there's a lot of countries where the use of smartphones is non-existent or very infrequent, you know, due to a number of reasons, economic and so forth. Infrastructure is also another big one. So when we look at this, I kind of wonder how they're looking at the distribution of this. Are they, I mean, I see that they're saying worldwide, but then they're also saying that people will likely have more than one mobile device. And that's the part that to me is a little bit amazing. I mean, right now I have, you know, cable internet here at home and my own Wi-Fi network and so forth. And I can see a time not too far in the future where all of my devices just connect mobily, that I won't need to have my own Wi-Fi or cable internet. They'll just all connect through a mobile provider. Maybe I'll have my own virtual network of some sort for my home, or that, you know, so my devices can interconnect. But that's where I really see this headed, where everything is mobile. You know, home networks don't need to really exist. And obviously people are doing tons more with their mobile devices. They mentioned video, which of course, you know, many people currently stream on their mobile devices. And I think that's only going to increase. And, you know, I got to tell you, we've come a long way from my old Motorola flip phone that I used to use way back in the day with its 10 speed dial memory. So it's just amazing to see this getting faster and more prevalent, less expensive. Really incredible.
That's a good point about expense, though, because internet in the United States is so much more expensive than in other countries until you get Google. Google is expanding its Google Fiber service to Atlanta, Nashville, Charlotte, and Raleigh, among, I don't know, like 18 other cities. And
still not Columbus, Ohio, just saying.
No, it's still not in my neighborhood either. But Ting is also another company that's jumped into the fray. Ting is better known at the moment for providing affordable cell service. I'm a subscriber. I jumped ship from Sprint. And now they're tackling fiber. And they're starting off in Charlottesville, Virginia, and in Westminster, Maryland. And I got to say, you know, the ubiquity of all this internet, it can only be a good thing for blind people, right? Because with so many apps and whatnot that are relying on data, this can be a good thing, right? I mean, I'm excited about it.
I think could be a good thing, but that depends on the developers creating that environment that access technology can actually access. Yeah, we encounter that all the time on web pages.
Yep.
And not even just developers, but there are people that, you know, a lot of us, we're all online, obviously, but there are some who still don't want to be. And so it would be good for those, I think, who really want it, but other people, it really won't matter to them. So
yeah, and I guess I meant more like some of the hardware also, you know, that could depend on this, you know, like beacons and different kinds of indoor navigation, you know, that can rely on these kind of Wi-Fi. I guess you really wouldn't call them hotspots. If they're so prevalent, it's not a hotspot anymore, right? So in that sense, I wonder if it could be a great thing. In fact, one of the companies that's coming out, a startup, Eero, I believe is how you pronounce it, is taking a crack at pushing mesh Wi-Fi through your whole house. So what happens right now, you have a router and you can set up an extender. You can usually only set up one extender. And so what happens if you have a large enough home, or even in some businesses, you have a bunch of dead zones. You know, you can't bounce through the material, the wall, whatever, you know. So mesh wireless is the answer. And what they're going to do is set up one router. That would be your standard, provide your standard DHCP. But then you'd have other devices that would work as nodes. And you can add as many nodes as you can or as you want through their cloud service to basically enclose your house in wireless service. And that's exciting for me because I have Verizon Fios. And yeah, I don't get the speeds that they advertise for one, but two, you know, I have a good router. I mean, I have a decent router. I have two of them, in fact, and I still get my dead zones. Any thoughts from you guys about some of these internet proliferation of things?
I saw this headline come through on my Twitter feed, and while I didn't click on the article at the time, I thought, wow, that sounds certainly very intriguing, and I think that the proliferation of, as more and more things tend to be going in the direction of the cloud and mobile connectivity, I think we're only going to see more items come out like this or that will involve mobile connectivity and cloud-based usage. So I think this could be good. I know in my building, it's a brick building, and so sometimes it's hard to get cell signal and things too. So maybe I don't know if this would improve that at all, but maybe in the future it might too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's going to set you back $125 if you want just one router. It's going to be about $300 for a three-pack of, and this is set to launch in the spring of this year. So we'll have to keep tabs on that, see how it comes out, and let's see if it's accessible, because as Lane pointed out, that absolutely, accessibility is a concern. And security is another concern, because hooray for better internet and more prevalent internet, but you know, the more access you have, the more open you leave yourself, the more vulnerable your devices can be. So we'll link to some security articles that you can equip your machine to protect yourself.
I found out about this mesh network thing 2 hours after I got the Amazon notification that my newest router has just shipped. So I thought, isn't that always the way? I'm excited about it, and I cannot get it because I spent a lot of money on this new router. So I'm excited about it. It'll be interesting to see how it goes. I hope it's accessible. That's my big concern with it. Mm-hmm. But the concept is really neat. And I honestly think it has to come down in price. I don't think home users are ready to pay $300, and that's just the introductory price for three of these things. I think I would be tempted just because I use internet everywhere and I'm a geek like that. But I think a lot of people, you know, if given the choice of $300 or, you know, a Linksys something for $80, I'm thinking this may not find a niche with the home user market. But for small businesses or geeks, yeah, I think this is going to definitely gain traction.
Or even communities. That's been something in rural Idaho and other, probably even in Montana, some of the mountain states, where the communities are coming together and creating citywide wireless systems, mm-hmm, or just like downtown wireless systems to connect to. I think it would have been a lot more affordable for the city of Sun Valley, for example, to maintain their wireless system that they had set up. They had free Wi-Fi downtown Sun Valley, Idaho, and that was recently discontinued because it was too expensive to maintain the hardware and the lines in all the different businesses where they had extenders. So in that type of setting as well, when the home consumer can't afford it and the community is offering it, or libraries is another place I'm thinking of too.
That's an interesting point, because right now there's a debate on Capitol Hill about whether or not governments should treat internet as a utility and just offer it as a, you know, through the local municipality. And I kind of like this idea of the community setting up their own system, right? Like whether it's a library or, you know, even just like a neighborhood, right? To get themselves connected. But either way, I mean, this is pretty exciting. You know, like I said at the outset, it's not a surprise that there are so many mobile users. But at some point, we do have to deal with the traffic. You know, how do you deal with that? Because the networks get bogged down, and we're still paying ridiculously high prices for slow internet.
And then depending on how the system is set up, I mean, you know, I've been on plenty of free Wi-Fi networks where it's like, okay, I think I'll switch and go back to my 4G on my cell phone, because yes, this Wi-Fi is free, but it's slower than anything. So that also is, like you say, not even, you know, may not even necessarily be traffic, but just signal in general. So
true. I know one thing that you won't be walking away from, Katie, and that's the Apple Watch. I was going to say smartwatch, which I guess it technically is, but it's coming out in April. What are you excited about it? First in line?
I am very excited. I'm actually very tempted to line up at my local Apple store. You know, there have been, I've read, you know, some articles, will it be accessible? Will it not be accessible? And as of right now, that's technically, I think, still yet to be determined. And I think that Apple, you know, they're still putting the finishing touches on it. Based on what I've seen, I think that Apple is definitely still committed to accessibility. And I am extremely optimistic that a new product such as the Apple Watch, because of the features that it has and the fact that it has a speaker and things, I'm optimistic that it will have voiceover accessibility in it.
Well, it has tactile controls too, right? And I think it is very dependent on the iPhone or iDevice.
It'd be really interesting. I'd love to hear. I've not, you know, obviously I've not seen any pictures. I'd love to, because the article that we linked to in the show notes has some pictures, I guess, of like a prototype or of, you know, what it looks like. I'd love to hear, you know, what it looks like. I know it's, you know, watch shape, but I think part of the only, you know, one of the only tactical things it might have would be, you know, the watch stem that you pull out to adjust things. So it will be interesting to see how it continues to develop and see what other interesting, crazy rumors will fly out there on Twitter.
Well, interesting that you mention what the pictures look like, because as we move into accessible technology, Be My Eyes has come out and has made quite a splash on the Apple App Store. The app connects blind people with volunteer helpers around the world through live video chat. And Lane, it's like an enhanced version of TapTapSee. Is that kind of a fair sort of assessment of it?
Yeah, you know, it's one of the disadvantages to TapTapSee and VizWiz was that you're relying on text feedback from a volunteer. And so you couldn't ask you couldn't get feedback from them. Where do I need to point the camera to give you a better shot? That sort of thing. You couldn't ask that volunteer specific information. So the Be My Eyes app allows you to connect basically like FaceTime. They have their own server and it doesn't specifically rely on FaceTime, but you get a little bit more contact with that volunteer. So you can ask specific questions to get the specific information. They can tell you where to move the camera so that they can get a better view of what you're trying to figure out. Kind of based on that same Good Samaritan type of foundation where you're relying on those volunteers.
I actually know two people who volunteered as sighted assistants to help with the app. So if any of you are out there listening and are sighted and are helping, thank you. And if you are considering signing up, we really appreciate your assistance.
Absolutely. And if you don't get tapped to help, and I was reading the comments in the App Store, and I guess there were some low ratings because they hadn't been asked to help yet. But as another commenter pointed out, you know, this is actually a good thing. It means that there are so many people volunteering that they haven't gotten around to you. But please stick with it because there are people that are using it.
And those reviews definitely show that there are a lot of well-intentioned individuals. There were also some reviews out there on that review for iTunes that demonstrated to me that there's sighted guys out there who think, oh, those poor blind people. And so it's just one more opportunity, hopefully, to educate people who think, oh, those poor blind guys, what would they do without me? You know, like, there's a balance there between being helpful and, I don't know what to call it, but that over helpfulness, really, where people think, gosh, what would they do without me? And personally, I can do without it. I can use my smartphone or my computer and connect with friends and family. I don't need a random volunteer out there from the world. That doesn't mean I won't someday, but you know, right now, like the way that things are set up for me, I would much rather trust things that I'm trying to identify in my environment to friends and family. And I'm the other feeling. Places that I need help. Yeah. And there's other places, like the other places I need help are when I'm out, you know, I travel quite a bit for work. So when I'm in a new city and my GPS, that wonderful seeing eye GPS app doesn't always work. And it'll say that your destination's on your right and it's an open field. So you're getting feedback, you know, that immediate feedback. I'd rather grab somebody on the street than be distracted from my environment by being on my phone. So I think there's a great place for it. I'm really grateful to specifically those individuals who have volunteered and really truly mean well, but aren't sitting there waiting for a call because, oh, those poor blind people. I hope that they're getting educated.
Right. Steve, any thoughts?
She just spoke them all. I agree 100%. I think the app is a cool concept, but I mean, although there's been quite a bit of buzz generated from the blindness community, there's been, I think, more buzz generated from the heroic sighted community who are happy to have another way to, you know, race in and rescue those poor blind people. And they are retweeting these posts that are like, I just helped a blind man identify his carton of milk in the fridge. And I think to myself, why couldn't he do that himself? I mean, this right. isn't like reading print. It's like, you know, oh, I helped a blind man figure out where his coffee was. Or it's like, you know, who is using it for this? And do you really need it, or are you just playing around? I just want to smack these people. Which,
I think there is some of that, though. I mean, I think there really are people who, you know, maybe they're adjusting to blindness, or, you know, maybe they have other disabilities in addition to blindness, or, I mean, who knows? Like, it's, you know, we don't know. Maybe they are just being silly, but
they do exist, and I totally see that. I mean, but on the other hand, I think the problem is that these people they're doing it as a volunteer and they're proud of it, but they're like, I've accomplished this major thing. And I don't know, it's almost like self-aggrandizing in a way, you know what I mean? It's
right.
I mean, you know, if I'm leaving a grocery store and I help someone with their groceries or something because their hands are full and they've got kids with them and everything else, and I just offer to carry their groceries, I don't immediately pull out my cell phone and say, you know, I helped this mom with three kids load up her car with groceries because I'm just a nice guy. You know, I mean, it's, you do it and you think, hey, I did a good thing and I, you know, that's pretty awesome. And because this is all getting retweeted, it sort of, in my mind at least, it furthers this, you know, I'm doing an awesome thing for those poor blind people mentality. Yeah, so,
and why aren't you? Here I am doing this great thing for these blind people. Why aren't you kind of thing perpetuating that?
Exactly.
Yeah. A misconception that every blind person needs this much extensive help.
Well, so again, I think it comes back to us, you know, to our education of, you know, we're all different. Yes, some of us might need some additional assistance and some of us may only ever use this app, quite frankly, one or two times for those few tasks that we really can't figure out on our own or by some other means. So I think it's...
What if all of these volunteers aren't honest Good Samaritans? You know, I think about some of the things that I have used FaceTime and Skype and Google Hangouts with friends and family. And a lot of it has been finding things in the house. A lot of times it's contacting my husband, where did you put this? So he'll have me hang out so that he can look around and figure out where he put it. Right. And, you know, and I think, gosh, do I want a stranger knowing the layout of my house?
Yep.
A lot of these guys really probably have the best of intentions. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's always that 1-10% that don't. And then I also wonder about the security of the Be My Eyes server. Are they recording any of your video? Can that get out so that anybody can have access mm-hmm. to the video inside your home? Or what if you inadvertently have them looking at your credit card statement? You're looking for something on a table, like a specific piece of paper, and it just so happens that a credit card statement happens to be in that pile. That security thing, and there's a level of personal responsibility there to know that it's your credit card statement versus something else. But if you live with sighted people, stuff happens.
Yep.
And my papers get mixed up all the time.
Right.
Or if you're blind and just throw your mail on the table and you think, oh, what's that again? What's that pile of print that I need to look at?
Yeah.
There's also no way to report a volunteer that I know of. And that freaks me out a little bit. Is there?
Yes, there is. Oh, there is. I saw a audio boom demonstration done by Darren Duff where there is a report button where you can report your volunteer if you've had a poor experience. The volunteers can also, if you happen to show explicit content that is offensive to your volunteer, they can report you as well.
That's good.
Well, yeah. That's good to know.
It's worth noting also on the other side of the coin is for if you are using the app to not just be smart about security, but also not to abuse it, you know, not to be silly on it, because unfortunately we are ambassadors for each other. It shouldn't be that way, right? But it, just as much as they can abuse it, so can we. But it is a free download on the App Store. If you want to check it out, it's available in 23 different languages. So even though my colleagues here seem to be united in their hate of it, maybe hate's not the right word, but definitely not fans.
That's a little strong.
Yeah. Maybe, I'd say skepticism or I don't know.
Fair enough.
Mistrust. I don't quite know what would be the most accurate adjective, but.
Yeah.
Skepticism is definitely, I think, probably the best descriptor. But I'm always the devil's advocate. I can always find good if somebody else is finding all the bad, and I can find the bad if somebody else is always finding the good.
And on the other side of this break, new app, new update, new book, and how to become Batman on the Zero Talk Podcast.
When I got my computer 7 years ago, I really knew nothing about it. And I mean absolutely nothing. I had never sat at a computer. Back in those days, most computers were PCs, and I had a Gateway, beautiful looking thing, but all I knew was how to turn it on and the wrong way of turning it off. I called a friend of mine down in Port Huron, and I asked him to tell me how to turn the computer off correctly, and he told me. But still, I knew nothing about really the ins and outs of using a computer. And then I met System Access. A friend of mine told me about it, and she was using it on her computer, and she explained to me, not just by telling me, but actually demonstrating to me how simple it really was. And I says, I want to get that. And that night, I sat there and downloaded System Access, and she actually purchased my first month's service, and I was hooked. Really, what hit me was how simple System Access is to use. You have a numbered menu, and you can do many different things. And I can even look up news and weather and listen to DVS movies. I mean, these are things I never thought were possible. And I remember I almost cried when I went up on the Pipe Dreams website. It's a site that National Public Radio has devoted completely to organ music. And when I went up there and hit the link, I remember just how simple that was and how proud I was. I even told my mom. And that's my testimonial for System Access.
Thank you to Wally for that awesome and unsolicited testimonial. He posted it on Samnet. We weren't expecting that, but he gave us permission to share it with you all. And it just makes life so much easier when someone else tells the Serotech story. So thank you, Wally, for that. And speaking of stories, Katie, have you read any good stories recently on, say, Audible?
I have, and thanks to Audible, they make reading stories easy for me, and I like that. So one of the books that I've just started to read is the book Gray Mountain by John Grisham. I know it's been out for a while, but I'm a little bit behind on reading it, but I just started it, so I'm looking forward to reading that and hearing the great voices of the Audible narrators. They do a fantastic job, and I'm a John Grisham fan, so I'm sure that this book will be a great listening/reading experience.
Absolutely. I think Catherine Tabor is the narrator on that. I've listened to it. It's fantastic. You know, audiobooks are great for when you're on your commute, when you're doing house chores. You know, it's a good thing to have in the background, and it's a fantastic sound. So highly recommend it. If you have not downloaded your free audiobook, you can do so at audiblepodcast.com/SerilTalk. And a big thank you for Audible for continuing to support the network. There is, I think, a lot of good things in the Voice Dream Writer.
You know,
given this look.
I was on the fence about it for the longest time. I have a lot of writing apps, and I thought the last thing I need is one more app that will let me be productive, because if I can avoid productivity, that's the way to go. Anyway, I read about this, and everyone, of course, is all excited about it. It's made by the same person who made Voice Dream Reader, and Voice Dream Writer, as you may have guessed, is a writing app. It has a number of really cool features, and the more I get into it, the more excited I actually have become about it. One of the features is that, of course, it's accessible for folks who are blind and low vision, but they've also have a lot of features in there for folks with print disabilities. So if you are not sure about the spelling of a word, you can spell it phonetically, like E-N-U-F for enough, and it will try to find the correct word for you. You also can type in a definition, for example, fast African cat, and it will suggest cheetah as a possible word that you're looking for. So for people that need assistance finding exact words or who are needing assistance with spelling, it has a lot of features in that regard. There's also built-in capability to get the definitions of words as you're typing them or as you're reading them. And for us, one of the neat features is that there's a spell checking component which will work like a traditional spell checker. What I mean by that is it will bring you to the first misspelled word, give you the suggestions, you can make your correction, and then you go to the next misspelled word. So it sort of steps you from one misspelling to the next, the way a traditional spell checker would work. And it's probably just me being old-fashioned, but the sort of inline spell checking thing that we have on the iPhone drives me absolutely bananas. I never can.
I turn mine off.
I do too. I always get the wrong thing.
I can't do it.
Yeah, it's
like, that's not what I want. No, stop it.
So I mean, this has this is worth the $7 or whatever it costs just for this feature, in my opinion. It will literally, you know, step you through each word that's misspelled, and you can choose the correct spelling. Fully accessible. You can export your document into a number of formats, including Microsoft Word, which is exciting. You can also, I think, export to Dropbox and maybe Google Drive. I'm not sure. Definitely Dropbox. And it probably has a bunch of other features I'm not thinking of. Oh, it has Heather. It has the ability to install voices such as Heather and the other voices that are available for VoiceDream Reader. So if you want that more human-sounding, I guess, voice, or if you prefer that voice over the iPhone voices, you can get those and use it with it as well. So it's pretty neat. I use Braille input a lot on my iPhone, the on-screen Braille keyboard. And this is great for that because it's a pain if you use the on-screen Braille. It's a pain to switch back and forth for editing, because if you want to edit something, you have to use your rotor and get out of the Braille keyboard and then change your orientation and edit and then switch back so you can type. It's a real pain. So with this, I can just type and not worry about it. And then when I'm all done, go and spell check and do my edits. They also have a copy and paste, well, a select function that is way easier than the... Yeah, it's much easier than the pinch gesture thing.
I can never get that right on the iPhone. It never works for me.
It doesn't, it's supposed to. Steven, doesn't it also give you an option to read like the current character or the current word? When I'm moving my cursor around in my iOS, sometimes I forget, am I at the beginning, am I at the end? Because I'm switching back and forth between Apple and how the Apple VoiceOver responds to how you move your cursor compared to Windows. Doesn't it do a current cursor, character?
I think it does, yeah. I turned most of that off, but yes, if you're used to the way that the cursors work on Windows and you want the app to give you feedback instead of the sort of traditional VoiceOver feedback that we get, you can enable that, and then it'll work sort of like a Windows app would work.
Yeah, it just seemed like the focus stayed more focused when I was typing
Yeah.
or editing.
I was originally very skeptical because I thought, you know, I already have drafts. I've got, like I say, I've got a bunch of other programs for writing. And I thought, why do I need another one? And, you know, is it worth the $7? I mean, you know, I'm glad I bought it. There's a lot of functionality in this that the other apps just don't have. I mean, I don't know that I'll use this exclusively. I still love Draft, which is another app. If you're not familiar with it, that has a lot of neat integrations and things like that. And I'll definitely still continue to use that. But this is great for writing documents that you have to edit or that you may have to give to someone in Word or that you can use Dropbox to quickly synchronize things between your computer and your iOS device. So I'm definitely happy I went ahead and purchased it for sure.
It's $9.99 on the App Store if you want to check it out. It's something definitely worth checking out. Kurzweil version 14 is out. And among other features, you can extract images to PDF files. You can recognize PNG files, record voice notes, and perform advanced editing. Now, my question to you, Katie, is there a place still for adaptive software for OCR?
I think there is. I have used Kurzweil in the past, but honestly, right now, what I personally prefer to use is DocuScan Plus, actually, which happens to be another product made by Serotek. The reason I like that is because it's cross-platform, so it works on Windows and Mac and everything. So I think, though, for those, again, who are blind and visually impaired, but also may have other disabilities, there is still a place for Kurzweil or for the right instance. I know with this feature, you can also, with this upgrade, the article also mentions the ability to record voice notes. So that might be helpful for some people as well as they're moving through texts.
Absolutely. I mean, there are mainstream products out there, FindReader certainly being one of them. And FindReader is one of the engines in Kurzweil and OpenBook. They're, you know, it's a simplified version of the driver of the engine. But, you know, I wrote actually an article recently making a case for using mainstream instead of the, quote, overpriced assistive technology. But that being said, someone pointed out rightfully so that you need to use what works for you. And absolutely. So if it is Kurzweil, yeah. And the updates, I don't think are, I mean, the full, when you buy it outright at first, it's like $8.95, but I believe the update is $125. So if those features work for you, by all means, check that out.
So a bit ago, we were talking about mobile too, and I don't think that the mobile platform is going to, in the near future, be nearly as good as Kurzweil's or the OpenBooks or the DocuScan Plus options for scan and read.
Right. Yeah, good point.
Mainstream or not.
Yeah. Talk to your computer. It might just talk back to you. This comes to us via Hargen Consultancy. This is a PC app that lets blind people use an integrated version of Dragon Natural Speaking and JAWS. Have you guys checked this out? Do you guys ever get around to using it?
I had a client who used an older version of this. This is a number of years back, and it was really neat. It was really, really well done. And the way that it sort of handles this, you know, JAWS not talking when you're needing to talk thing, and the ability to issue commands for JAWS, which are traditionally or difficult with traditional speech-to-text programs, it was very, very impressive. I don't know that personally I would use it or that I would have a need for it, but it's an incredibly well done. It's a very high-quality product. So for people that need to have speech recognition and JAWS, it's a great solution.
So definitely an expensive solution, and it's also a resource hog. I've tried using it several times with consumers, and we continually run into the problem of the computer freezing. Mm. And there have been a variety of other issues that I've encountered with older versions that I hope are fixed. It was interesting to see that they released early, that they came out ahead of schedule.
Ahead of schedule, yeah.
With their most recent version.
Yeah. I wonder, with something like that, because I've also heard that NVDA tends to slow down people's computers. I wonder how much of that is RAM. I mean, I know RAM helps out sometimes, but also one of the things that I did for my computer that was the best thing I ever did for my old computer was to switch out the mechanical drive for an SSD. JAWS works so much better. So I don't know, maybe that's an idea worth looking into. And not all old computers are going to be able to take a solid state drive, but in addition to a quicker login and whatnot, I've just noticed far less issues with screen readers. So that's one way to.
And the combination of tools tends to be pretty overwhelming for people too, particularly if they're brand new to using their computer mm-hmm. by voice control and by speech recognition.
True.
Honestly, yeah. I've been having people transition using other products into figuring out how to use JAWS and JSAY. And a lot of times they've been sticking with Guides Hand Free or CDesk with Peggy and in those proprietary environments rather than switching to JAWS. With JAWS and JSAY, I mean, it's an interesting dynamic between talking to your computer and hearing it.
And the company actually challenges you to, you know, because some people make the case, you know, well, why should I use JSAY when I can just buy Dragon Naturally Speaking and JAWS and go from there, cut out the middleman. It's not a good experience, though.
It's really hard to train.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. If you're going to go that route, go with Windowize and Dragon. It's a little easier to train. A little.
Oh, okay.
What about Windows dictation? I remember there was a great podcast on Serotech. This was years ago now. I think Windows
Michael
Vista
Loft, I think, did it.
Yeah. Was the thing. Yeah, it was like Matt did it, I think, and this is like ages ago. But I haven't heard a thing about Windows dictation since then.
You know, I actually, rather than putting somebody on JAWS and JSAY recently, because they were new to both vision loss and the physical impairment that made it difficult for them to use the computer, I had them using Windows Dictation and Narrator on Windows 8 very successfully. Awesome. I was incredibly impressed. It was the most seamless combination that I have experienced in the last 7 years. Even comparing it to, well, I don't know if you guys are familiar with CDesk and Peggy, but there's a lot of configuration that goes on in the background to make that happen. And using Windows 8 Narrator and Windows Dictation, it was very seamless. It was easy to train. The feedback was very responsive. And the command structure that for giving text voice commands was intuitive. And the response from Narrator was instant.
Lots of developments in AT so far in 2015, and if you haven't checked out the Blind Bargains coverage of ATIA, you can do so at their audio index, which we'll link to in the show notes. So Jonathan Mosen came out with a new book. It's Become an Amadeus Pro Maestro. Katie, you have some thoughts on this?
I do. I have not yet bought this book, but I think it could really be a very useful tutorial for those wishing to get into more audio production, and especially on the Mac side of the house. I use a Mac computer and Windows, but I'm always looking for, I'd like to get more into audio production and working more with audio, and especially on the Mac side if I can. So I'm looking forward to purchasing this product and checking out what Mr. Mosen has to say about this app and experimenting with it.
There are some incredible Twitter reviews.
There are 4 hours worth of creating ringtones, digitizing vinyl or cassettes, converting and reprocessing audio, recording interviews, podcasting, broadcasting. So definitely a lot of stuff to check out there. And it's available in DAISY.
It's available in DAISY and MP3. And at the time of this recording, you can purchase both for the price of $35, which for a book in those formats is quite a deal.
Absolutely. And Jonathan's such a great, he's an innovative guy. Awesome stuff. So, I mean, you know that when you buy his products, you know you're going to get something quality. So definitely check that out. Well, there is certainly a lot more to have been covered in ATIA, certainly happened in late January. And if you have not checked out Blind Bargains Audio Index, by all means, check it out. They've done over 80 minutes of coverage. We will link to that in the show notes, and you will also find out about their podcast. So best of luck to them. Fantastic job over there. Well, in the human interest section, there is an article that claims that brain scans reveal the way blind people see is really not that different from anyone else. Our understanding of what it means to see is so yesterday. A study published in Cell Press challenges the notion that seeing is consumed through the eyes and processed in the brain. The Hebrew University in Israel found the same part of the brain that is used to read print is also activated when people read Braille. Perception of heightened senses is something that these articles tend to talk about, and I want to pause here for a moment. Tell me, you guys, being blind, do you feel like your hearing is better? And this is relevant because we're about to talk about our other article that goes hand in hand with this one. But is your hearing better? Because my hearing seems normal.
Mine seems fine. But it could just be me.
Normal. I pay more attention to what I hear.
Yeah.
But right. I wouldn't say that my hearing's better.
Mm-hmm. I think my mom who explained it, she explained it to me because we were talking about this. And she said when I was little, I used to ask, you know, what's that noise? And what's that sound? And she said, you know, you listen with your ears all the time and I'm looking around with my eyes all the time and not listening as much. So it's just, again, a sense of more in tune to the sounds of our environment.
Right. Neuroplasticity is the process that this article talks about. And that's where the brain rewires the lost sense to other regions. Now, the article also references a recent episode from Invisibilia. This is an NPR production. And it tells us a story of Daniel Kish. And Daniel Kish uses echolocation to get around. Echolocation, not a new concept. We've heard about it for several years, maybe longer. Where do you guys fall on this? I mean, is it a useful travel technique? Are we maybe overlooking something valuable for the blind community?
I actually personally wouldn't use it when I'm traveling. You know, I might, if I'm walking into a room or something, snap my fingers once to kind of get a sense of space. But I personally wouldn't use this method when I'm walking out and about. But if it works, again, as we said earlier with some of the tech, you know, if it works for one person and they've made it work, well, echolocate away.
I personally, it's not something I use by itself.
Right.
When I'm, you know, I use, and this is just personal preference when it comes to cane travel, but I prefer the hollow solid canes with the metal tips because I get more auditory feedback off of the tap of that metal. But it's not my only source of material or strategy or tools for orienting myself to my immediate surroundings. But it is definitely valuable.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I think using your cane tip or snapping your finger, I mean, those are things that those are subtle things that you can use. I think the part that I get hung up on is using like the roof of your mouth to click. And I don't think that, you know, the podcast meant it as anything outrageous when they say, you know, how to become Batman, because it's not the superhero that we're talking about. It's a bat, you know, blind is a bat, right? And using echolocation just like bats do, that kind of made it difficult for me. Absolutely. You got to sell it. But I don't know. I mean, I think about it. My gut instinct, my initial reaction anyway, is I would never do that. You know, I'm not going to go walking down the street, drawing attention to myself, clicking my tongue. Mm-hmm. You know, to hear bounce off buildings. At the same time, though, I wonder if it's a barrier that we might be putting up for ourselves. Because, for example, with sunglasses, you know, I come out and it's bright sometimes, and I don't wear sunglasses in part because I haven't found a lens that will let me see in a way, you know, it doesn't completely black out what little sight I have left. But so also, I feel like, you squint. But then I also feel like I wear sunglasses, I'm, you know, doing the whole Stevie Wonder thing. So am I inhibiting myself, you know, and kind of ruling this thing out that could potentially help me out?
Mm-hmm. And, it's not as intrusive as you might think. A couple of friends and I used to use, it sounds so silly now, but at one point we would use, when we got separated in the mall or in large stores or that sort of thing, we would use those little sounds and they weren't as intrusive as you might think. It was much less as intrusive than playing Marco Polo through the mall.
Well, I think going back to Joe's point about the, and that's a good point that you make, Lane, is that on the podcast, I think it seemed really out there and really, you know, we picked up on it and noticed it right away, but it was in a relatively quiet setting. I mean, I think if you were doing it walking down the street with, you know, a busy environment, people probably wouldn't think twice or wouldn't notice it at all.
Right. I think it's interesting that apparently they can recognize objects, and that's the part that I find it a little bit difficult to believe, but that's also could be that part of my brain just isn't turned on or isn't tuned into that frequency. I don't know. I mean, you can tell the difference between a bowl and a fruit, I don't know, watermelon, I guess the example was.
And I think that takes training. You know, I can now tell the difference with my cane between a parking meter and a street sign. You know, they're both metal poles. They're both hollow metal poles, but I can tell the difference between the parking meter and the street sign. It's just a matter of a familiarity with your environment and that understanding of what's in the environment. So I don't think it's going to be intuitive for most people, but at the same time, with enough training, just about anything's probably possible. Well, not probably, it is possible.
I think it could be done, but I would still encourage people to use mobility aids such as a white cane, or if they choose a guide dog or go sighted guide, just for everyone's safety when you're out and about.
True, and I think in the podcast, it even talks about him using a cane. What I did find inspirational about this piece is that he has worked with a number of children, Daniel Kish has, and has kind of challenged them to get out there, you know, climb trees, do things that overprotective parents might not have let their children do before. And he's getting out there and he's doing this with them, and that's a good thing, you know, to get them out there. The way that he does it, maybe, is unconventional for me, maybe for you listening as well. But, you know, it's a different way to get around. And
you know, even some of these recordings aren't as popular as I've been led to believe in my life and my experience. But even Fred Schroeder indicates that in the past, he has relied on echolocation. He rode a bike for years and years and years until finally somebody told him, "You're blind, you can't do that." And he wasn't trained to use the echolocation, but that's probably what he was doing to ride his bike as a totally blind kid. And so a lot of it is in that presentation. How do you encourage parents to let their kids go out and do that? Because not all of us have parents like Fred did. I wish that recording was more available to people.
I remember when I was younger, I used to do, I mean, I guess I subconsciously sort of, I didn't know it was echolocation at the time, but I just learned how I could hear echoes. And I didn't have a cane until I was, you know, 9. I know they're giving them to kids much younger these days, but back in my day, you know, I was 9. And so you learn other ways to get around. You pay attention to what's under your feet. You pay attention to where other people are walking, and you pay really close attention to how things sound and how echoes sound. And yet, you know, my teachers, when I would try to talk about this concept to them, you know, would be, they sort of dismissed me as crazy. Like, no, that's, you know, you're wrong. You need to be able to touch this. You need to feel this. You can't tell, you know, that it's there just by hearing it. It's not making any noise. It's, you know, it's a school bus, but it's not running. So you can't tell that it's there. You need to be able to touch it. And I said, no, I don't, you know, I can do this. And No, that's not good. And I think, you know, if they had, you know, encouraged me to use a cane for safety reasons and so forth, but not totally disregarded this whole echolocation concept as just the silliness of a child, you know, maybe I would have found a way to integrate it more. You know, I wouldn't walk around clicking my tongue and stuff, but, you know, I also probably would have found better ways to integrate it in my life. And I just, it kind of makes me wonder how many other kids sort of intuit this and they don't know what to call it. It's just, it's what they know. And yet, you know, parents and other professionals just dismiss it. And the kid thinks, gosh, I must be wrong. You know, everyone else is, you know, telling me something different.
And that's a wrap, folks. I want to thank you all for joining us on this episode of the Start Talk podcast. Katie, if people want to get in touch with you, how can they go about doing that?
Probably the best way would be I'm on Twitter. My username there is Holnan, Holnan.
Fantastic.
So feel free to tweet me.
I say Twitter's probably the best way for me as well. If you can remember how to spell both my first and last name, Lane _ Amaro, Laine _ Amoureux.
In the show notes, folks. It'll be in the show notes.
Yeah, check out the show notes.
And Steve, sir, how do we get a hold of you?
Well, Twitter is the easiest way because my last name is such a pain to spell. On Twitter, I am Steve of Maine, like the state, as that's where I was originally from. So Steve of Maine.
Yeah, and if you want to get in touch with me on Twitter, I am @ Scribbling Joe. course, if you want to send us comments about today's episode, you can email them to resources@cerotalk.com, tweet them at Cerotalk, or use your iBlink Radio app to send us an iReport. I want to encourage you to listen to our upcoming SBN special, where we'll be interviewing Rose Sloan from the National Federation of the Blind, as well as Eric Bridges from the American Council of the Blind. They will both be telling us about their legislative priorities for 2015. These are issues that we as a community should come together, pay attention, and lend our support. The company behind this production is Cerotech Corporation. The guy responsible for making us all sound good was Patrick Perdue. And I'm Joe Orozco, saying we'll do this again next time on the Cerotalk Podcast. Thank you for listening.